And now I would like to introduce our main speaker, Jerry from San Diego.
I'm Jerry M., and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for showing up tonight. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I drove up in the parking lot and saw a lot of people talking to each other and laughing and having a great time. And I saw the disordered way the meeting is processed, and I knew I was at home. I just love this meeting. My story is a pretty plain and bland story. It's a very average, everyday, common story of a guy that drank a little bit and then drank a little bit more and drank a little bit more and kept drinking. And Teresa, I loved your story. And I didn't never meet the top of a table. I was really shy until I started drinking. And I'd like to start by welcoming the newcomers, and I'm glad you're here. And happy birthday, Teresa and Harry. My drinking story, started very close to where we're at right now. There's a 7-Eleven right up on the corner. There used to be a gas station there. And when I was 14 years old, I went in the gas station, bought a 7-Up, and three of my buddies had stole some I.W. Harper whiskey from a garage right here, right close by. And I drank that in the bathroom, mixed the whiskey with the 7-Up. And when that toxin hit my 14-year-old tummy, I became intoxicated. And my body wanted to throw off, naturally, the poison that was in there. And it expelled that poison. And I thought, wow, this is great. and that was my thought, my first thought. And so I kept drinking. And right around the corner from that 7-Eleven, where the gas station was, is Foster Elementary School. And some of our girlfriends were having a little social event there with their parents. And so the four of us traipsed over there right around the corner. And in a short period of time, we were on our way to juvenile hall as drunk and disorderly minors in a public place. And that was my career. I started my career right here, very close by. And I think that might be a pretty common story about drinking and not feeling well and getting into some trouble. An amazing thing happened with that. That was on a Friday night, and spent the weekend in juvenile hall. And Monday morning, I went to school, and instead of being on the fringe periphery of the in-group, I was in the middle of the in-group, because whatever I did was really cool. And I really liked that acceptance. I mean, I really have been trying to get in the middle of that group for a long time, and alcohol worked for me. It got me right there. So 90 days later, I ended up in juvenile hall again, drunk and disorderly minor in a public place. And I was really cool, but at home, it was grim. And my dad said that he had been married to my mom for 15 years, and he had never seen her cry before. And he said in a very strong way that he'd never wanted to see her cry again and didn't want me to make her cry. And I took that to heart. He was, my folks were wonderful people. Good people, and didn't drink. I never saw them drink at home. My mom was very religious, very spiritual lady, and drugged me around to the church on a regular basis, you know, a couple times a week, to make sure that I had the basics of religion and spiritual understanding, and, you know, turn my other cheek. And then my dad was a kind of a man's man. He had been a prize fighter, and at the time he was a professional rodeo contestant. So he was a tough guy. And he always taught me to get off first, you know, if there's ever a problem. You know, at best defense is an offense, and my mom's saying turn the other cheek, so it's a classic dual message for a youngster, and I just didn't get it. And what I found out is that early in life, I didn't get a lot of things. I was started in school here at 4 years old, and I was smaller than, you know, all the buddies that I had. And they figured things out before I did, and so I didn't feel as smart as. And they ran faster than I did. And so I always followed. I was a follower. And if they did something, I did it. And wanted to be accepted by them. And then that experience at that school, that first time of being on the in-group, was very welcome to me. You know, it's like I didn't have to follow them. And I kind of figured it out that being popular in school is doing things that weren't acceptable, you know, in the adult world. And as time went on, I seemed to manage not to make my mom cry until I got out of the house. And I got out immediately at 17 years old and stayed right here in San Diego and lived on my own. And ended up in college, and barely got by. Just wanted to make sure that I had my C average, so my draft didn't get pulled on me. And so I had I worked full time, went to school full time, and partied full time, and it was a chore. But I did it well, and. And yeah, I was unlucky a few times. I ended up in San Diego jail and Tijuana jail, and I was just unlucky. You know, I was, you know, they got away and I didn't. And that's because I didn't run as fast, and I didn't figure it out. They figured it out. And every time I drank, I didn't get in trouble, and I didn't overdrink. But every time I went to jail, I'd been drinking. And I never connected those dots. I just couldn't figure out how in the heck a guy like me, a really a nice young man, could be that unlucky. And so anyway, time went on, and I did get married, and I did get divorced. And I got married again, and I had two little children. And had a bottoming event. Happened to me. Had what was read earlier is absolutely, you know, ad infinitum was me. When I heard that, I said, "Oh yeah, every one of them, you know, switching, doing whatever." I did all those things. I swore that I would not drink ever again with solemn oath. So many times, I cannot tell you. And then I had. Unfortunate situations where I had hurt other people, either physically or emotionally. And in the morning, I had this horrible, number one, hangover. Number two, I always felt tremendous guilt. I'll never forget that. I think I got sick and tired of being guilty and remorseful more than anything else. And I carried this guilt and shame with me, and I didn't carry it well. I didn't like that feeling. And I read that, you know, that there are people that had trouble and then they quit drinking. And so I tried to find out how that worked, and I never heard of AA. I never in my life heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just didn't know it existed. And it got to a point where I knew I was really different than other people, and I quit trying to find out. I just accepted that. And I was not a social drinker. I did not drink in bars. And when I came to the program, and fortunately on page 21, it says, now how about the real alcoholic? And I am a real alcoholic. If anybody in here has never seen one, okay, you're looking at one now. Because when it said, I read that, about how about the real alcoholic, it perfectly described me. I mean, it was like, I thought both of my wives had called AA and turned me in, because it was honestly my story in every facet, and it talks about in that paragraph that you know, a pretty nice guy, and it progresses and becomes a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And both of my wives had called me Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They said, we don't know, you know, or they didn't say, wait a minute. I don't know. I don't know what's wrong, what it is about you, but you're a really a nice, caring person when you're not drinking. But once you start drinking, you're like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You become another person. And it says that if in that paragraph that if that person keeps drinking, they can become disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. And that was me. I was disgusting, and I was dangerous. And I was dangerous to myself and other people in a lot of different ways. And it goes on to say that this person will go to doctors and have be prescribed in there. It says, you know, some medication. I had five doctors, and two in San Diego, two in Phoenix, and one in El Centro, prescribing Valium for me because I was under stress. And what they didn't know was that the other doctors were prescribing for me. And I had found a miracle thing that happened. One day, I would go, if I had a hangover, I would go into your bathroom and look in your medicine cabinet, and I would take Midol or anything that would kill pain. Because I was really, had serious hangovers. And then I heard a doctor say that the reason for a headache and a hangover was that, you know, have a skull cap and the brain floats in this fluid, and alcohol makes the brain swell and it pushes the brain to the skull cap. And at the end of the head, the feet, the fingers are capillaries, and the pain comes from the hemorrhaging brain, from the capillaries that are bleeding. And for 27 years, my brain bled, this is toward the end. I found out, and I figured that I, you know, my brain cells, even though we have a lot of them, there might not be a whole lot left. And I was at the point where I could hardly tie my shoes. I didn't own any shoes that had strings in them. I could not read two sentences in a row in any book and remember what I read. And I couldn't write, and to this day I still suffer from brain damage. I did damage my brain, and fortunately, you know, it apparently repairs in certain areas. But I did have brain damage, and in that book, in that paragraph, it talks about being prescribed and then ending up in hospitals. And on Easter morning, 1983. I got my wife up and the kids, and let's go to church. And she said, we never go to church. What do you? I said, no, let's go to church. You know, it's Easter morning, and it'd be a good thing to take the kids to church. And we ended up in the intensive care part of a hospital, a local hospital, because I was bleeding, hemorrhaging internally, and I stayed there for about 5 days. So my drinking took me to hospitals. And so when I did read that on page 21, luckily it was early in my sobriety, I remembered it as being a very personal statement to me that I was an alcoholic. And that was on in April, I believe, that Easter day. And on July 29th, it was my daughter's birthday, and we were going to go to have a birthday at Chuck E. Cheese. And I got up that morning just the same as I got up every morning, and I left early to work. And before I left, I had about 8 Valium because they seemed to cure my hangovers, I thought. And I'd overdrank the night before, and I also drank half a pint of vodka, not to get high and party, but just to get even and stop the shaking from detoxing, from the sleeping. And by 2 o'clock that afternoon, they were supposed to be at Chuck E. Cheese, and I had my supply of cocaine in my house because I didn't carry it with me. And this has got to the point where it says in the book, you know, and other, you know, alcohol and other things. And I showed up at the house, and they hadn't left, and my wife and my sister and sister-in-law put their 2 children each, there's 6 kids, I had 2 kids, my sister had 2, my brother had 2, put them in my car and said, okay, you're going to drive the kids to school, and I mean to the party place. And I says, no, you don't understand, I can't do that. And they said, no, you don't understand, the girls are going to take some time off from the kids. And we were out in front of the garage, and my supply was in the garage, and I thought, how am I going to do this? So I went in the house, and I came out, and I said, there's a fire in the kitchen. And 3 ladies went in the kitchen. I got my supply. They came out, and they said, there's no fire. And I said, really? You know? And it seemed totally normal to me because I tell my wife that, you know, I'd left my briefcase in the office, and I have to go get it at 10 o'clock when I found out my supply was gone at 10 o'clock at night. And she says, well, why don't you go at 5 in the morning? You know, go early. And no, I finally convinced her it would be a good idea, and I'd leave, I'd come back, and she'd say, where's your briefcase? And so it's just part of the story of telling little, you know, untruths that lead to another untruth that leads to another untruth, and it's a terrible way to live from personal experience. And so the kids, we take off. I medicated myself and felt just great. And heading toward the party, and I ran 2 stoplights, one after another. And it's only by the grace of God we didn't get killed. Because from all kinds of traffic in these 2 stoplights, always. Very, very high traffic intersections. And by the time I got there, I swore again, I'm never going to do this. And that lasted 3 weeks until we had a family member come in with a dozen roses, going to stay overnight, and a bottle of wine. And one glass wouldn't hurt me. And so I really drank way too much that night. And that next morning, on the way to work, I heard on the radio, if you know of a friend that's having a problem or you're having a problem with alcohol, call this number. So I called the number, told them I had a friend. They said, great, knowing that he's talking to me. And told me just this, I was wondering why this guy would tell me all these secrets. And then he says, well, why don't you meet me at this meeting Tuesday night, 8 o'clock? And so I agreed to. So I went home. Passed the liquor store on the way home, and I went to this meeting, walked in, sat down, and it was just like coming here tonight. People were laughing and having fun and talking, and I thought, I'm not in the right place, because I thought alcoholics were, you know, down and out, and what they talked about was how to drink 2 drinks and then stop. That's what I thought alcoholics talked about. And I walked into the head area in a hospital, and there's a lady there, and I didn't want to ask her where the AA meeting was because she might think I was an alcoholic. And I was not an alcoholic. I had a little drinking problem. And so here comes, and I was way too young to be an alcoholic. And in comes these 3 young guys, and they said, where's the AA meeting? And I could feel my face getting red. I was embarrassed for them. She's going to think that they're alcoholics. And so I followed them, went into this meeting, sat down in the back of the room, and one of these young fellows was from Miramar. He's a Marine. And he started leading the meeting, and his subject was fear. And I thought, what? Fear? I mean, what does that have to do with drinking? You know, what in the world does that have to do with drinking? And what is a young Marine afraid of? Right? And he started talking, and all of a sudden he broke down, and whatever he's saying, he started crying. And I went, what? A Marine crying in front of all these people. And then the next guy that talked was a Catholic priest with his collar on, with a very heavy Irish brogue. And he started talking. He says he's going into the hospital. He thinks he has cancer. He knows he has cancer. And he says, I don't believe in God. I don't know if there is a God. And I'm afraid. And I thought, a Catholic priest that doesn't believe in God and a Marine crying, this is too much. And they said, okay, keep coming back. And we had greeters just like we had tonight. And thank you so much for greeting. That's a great, great institution of AA that I love to see. And they said, keep coming back and don't drink between meetings. And on the way home, I took off and I'm driving real dark, and it's August 23rd, and it's raining so hard that my windshield wipers won't take away the water, and I have to pull off the side of the road. Then I realize it's not raining. These are actually tears coming out of my eyes. And I thought, huh, what? And I don't remember. I was known for not crying even when I was small. And all of a sudden, way down deep in my stomach, I felt this like a rumble, a thumping or something. And then it came up to my chest. The next thing, it was a sob. And then the next thing, I broke down and I was crying. And I cried and cried, and then I started laughing, and I started thinking, they must have put acid in the coffee. That's what the alcoholics do. They don't drink. And then all of a sudden there was a revelation. I was by myself, and it was very dark. And there was a revelation, and what that revelation was that there were people out there like me that weren't drinking, that did not want to drink, and they had a way out, and they talked something about God, and that they were happy and laughing, and their lives were wonderful. And I realized and recognized that all my life I had been afraid of everything, and this wall of denial just crumbled right there. And all of a sudden, I knew I was going to be okay. And it was like I was levitating on the seat of my car. I had to hold on to my steering wheel. And so I went home and went to the deepest sleep that night. Got up early in the morning. Had to fly to Phoenix because I worked there. And passed up the bar on the way to the air. You know, at 6 in the morning, I didn't stop. Because I'm afraid of flying. I didn't need to have anything that morning. And I got there and went into a business meeting. I came out about noon. And it was August 24th in Phoenix. It's always about 130 degrees. It was hot. And I'm walking across this parking lot. And I see on a bumper, it says, let go and let God. And I'd seen that the night before. So this guy's working on his engine. I tapped him. I says, what does that mean? And he says, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And he talked to me for 45 minutes in that heat. And we stood there until we were both about ready to pass out. And he says, I got to go. And I says, yeah, me too. And so that night I was staying uncharacteristically at a hotel with some business associates. And that night, that evening, he said, okay, we'll see you down below. And I went up to get a Diet Coke, and I never get a Diet Coke ever in those days. And I walked up and I said, I'd like to have a Diet Coke. And the guy says, are you crazy? He says, you see all of this alcohol behind me? He says, it's free. You can have anything you want. And I thought it was like the devil or something. I mean, I just... And I went back and I told my buddy, I said, would you go get me a Coke? And what I recognized from that moment on, that's when I recognized it, that the obsession for alcohol was not there. And it has never returned to this day. That is my story. It has never, ever returned. I never used to say that to anyone because I thought they would give me the gate and say, you know, we fight it, we think about it, we dream about it. And but that is my story. I had a vital spiritual experience that night on my way home. And the obsession for alcohol and other chemicals was taken from me then. Never, ever to return. So I early in my sobriety, this guy, this Catholic priest that was in the room, he'd given me a tape, and he was a speaker, and it says, Father Bill in Yuma. And so I'd listened to it for about 90 days, and I'd loaned it to somebody, and I think they went out and took my tape with them. And so I saw Bill at a meeting that he went to on Tuesday night, same meeting. And by the way, 25 years later, I still go to that meeting, and there's about a dozen people that were in that room that night. That's how powerful Alcoholics Anonymous is in my life. And so I said, Father Bill, I says, can I have that tape in Yuma? And he says, I've got one in Fresno or Bakersfield. And I said, no, I need the one in Yuma. And he goes, why Yuma? And I said, I really like the story. And he goes, good God, man, I only have one story. I tell it everywhere I go. And that was another revelation in 90 days. I got one story. That's it. No more stories. I used to tell everybody a different story. And it was hard to remember what I told them. And this gets to the easier, softer way in my life. It was a spiritual awakening. I thought, one story? Wow, this is great. I can only tell one story. I don't have to remember all that other stuff. And I was, I'll backtrack to 30 days. I was on my way to my 30-day meeting. 30 days and then 31 days, and I wouldn't have to raise my hand in the first 30 days. And I was a happy camper. And so I was walking down the hall, and here's my wife holding our little son, little tiny baby, and my daughter was on her leg, holding onto her leg, and she's blocking the hallway. And she says, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm going to go to that Tuesday investors meeting that I always go on Tuesday night. Because I didn't want to tell her I was in AA, just in case I might go drink again. I wouldn't want to have to go through that route. So I told her I was going to an investors meeting. And she said, I want you to know I love you very much. And that kind of, I went, I love you too. And she goes, and I know you're having an affair. And I said, what? And she goes, I haven't seen you this happy in the 6 years that we've been married. She says, you're the happiest I've ever seen you. I've never seen you this happy. And I don't want you to leave me and the babies. And so I go where I used to hide my cocaine and alcohol, and I take out my big book. I says, I'm an alcoholic, the first time I ever told her. And I says, I want you to go to that meeting with me tonight. And she goes, you're not an alcoholic. She says, my dad died of alcoholism at 52. I was raised by an alcoholic, and you're not an alcoholic. I thought, really? Maybe I overreacted, you know? And these people had convinced me I was an alcoholic. So I says, no, go to this meeting, and here's all the stuff that I read, and she has come to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, is the greatest fellowship that she has ever known, by living with me in my recovery. Those children today are 27 and 30 years old. And on my belly button birthday, I get a call. On my AA birthday, they send me cards and call, and they've always said, "Thank you, Dad, for not drinking and raising us the way you've raised us." And they're talking about the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because in their life experience, they've seen friends where their families have been torn apart by the disease. And they've seen their friends die. One of my son's closest friends died in his arms while he was trying to give him CPR in a car wreck. And they are infinitely grateful that I'm not drinking. When they were both, they had this same teacher for the same class in the seventh grade. Something, I forget it was, some social thing. And they came to alcoholism and they says, "Gee, we wish we could get somebody here that could tell us something about alcoholism." My daughter, being the oldest one, raised her hand. She says, "My dad's an alcoholic. He'll come and talk." And I spoke twice in that same room because my son, when he got there, he says, "My dad's an alcoholic." And they're just so proud that I'm an alcoholic. And they've come to me as young adults and said, "You know, I want to talk to you." My daughter came to me one time. She says, I have a problem with cocaine." And we talked about that. And today she doesn't have a problem with cocaine. And my son has come to me. He says, "You think that you can get me checked into the McDonald's Center or something?" And I says, "I know a lot of people up there." I says, "When you're ready," I says, there's a bed for you." And he says, "No," he says, it won't take that for me." He says, "Thanks to you." And when I was early in, I did not get a sponsor right away. I was looking for a sponsor that looked like the Terminator, and I couldn't find him at meetings. And so I went to this one meeting one time, and this gal that I was sitting there with, she says, "I'm going to get a sponsor and do the steps." And I says, "Yeah, I think I need a sponsor." And a hand came on my, this guy's behind me, said, "I'll be your sponsor." I looked up, and he was about 5 feet tall and funny looking. I said, "No, I don't think so." And he turned out to be my sponsor, and he had a deep spiritual program, and he got me into the steps. And in 30 days, he had taken me through the steps, and I did have a spiritual awakening as a result of doing the previous 11 steps in order. And then he took me immediately to McDonald's Center and got me into the aftercare facilitator, and I did that for years. And then I've been doing service work ever since because people with... Today, I know a guy that has 50 years of sobriety, and he takes meetings into jails. And I think that I want to do what he does if he's been sober that long. And I do what they do. In my very first meeting of AA, my first 30 days, I figured out everybody in the room didn't have what I wanted. Everybody in that room didn't have what I wanted. Some people had what I wanted, but I didn't know what it was. But I know what it is today. They're calm, peaceful, and happy the majority of the time. Calm and peaceful and happy the majority of the time. And that is my story today. I do what they do. And I believe that the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous wants me to be calm and peaceful inside the majority of the time. Because if I'm calm and peaceful inside, when somebody needs help, then I can give away what I have. I can only give away what I have. That was calm and peaceful inside the majority of the time. I had a sponsor here in San Diego. His sponsor had been Bill W. And Bill W. told my sponsor that is what Bill thought the end result of sobriety was supposed to be, is to be available. The sponsor that I had, Dick H., said, He says, "What do you?" I referred to God's will about four times in a short period of time. He says, "Let me ask, what do you think God's will is?" And I told him, I says, "I do every get into action, do everything that I possibly can about the situation, and then I turn it over to God, and the way it turns out, that's God's will." And he said, "That sounds pretty vague to me." And I thought, vague? I thought, that's a pretty good answer. And he said, "Would you be interested in knowing what my sponsor?" That was the hook, you know. You know, I said, "Would you be interested in knowing what my sponsor thought about that?" And I said, "Yes, what did your sponsor think that God's will was?" And he said, "He thought that God's will was perfectly outlined in the St. Francis of Assisi prayer. You know, stay out of the negative, stay in the positive, stay out of yourself and get into others. Be of service." And I believe that, and that's my experience, my personal experience, is that when I'm thinking about the goodwill of others, that my problems really aren't as great as if I'm magnifying them by looking inside. My story is that I went all over the world looking, you know, to the places where all the prophets came from and read all the books and studied. And my mother's religion had a very specific God, and they all understood it, and I didn't get it, and I never found out what they thought their God was. And when I came in AA, it says the God of my understanding, and I found God in the last place that I looked, and that was inside me. And the God within me listens to the God within you. The God, the good in you is what I look for. And I've learned that through a lot of different sponsors. A lot of sponsors have really helped me by saying things like, you know, have a sponsor and take your problems to your sponsor and take solutions to meetings. Don't spread the disease at a meeting. There might be newcomers there. Don't spread the disease at the meeting. You know, take your problems to your sponsor and bring the solutions to the meetings. And that was one of many things that was very helpful that I learned from a sponsor. And the prayer that really, I love all the prayers that we read and hear, but the acceptance prayer is just very powerful to me. And what I can change, you know, the wisdom to know, you know, what can I change is my attitude toward whatever that is. And the attitude of acceptance. I accept what is, and I learned that from a sponsor. And I would like to end by saying that I'm honored to be in your presence. I'm honored to be in the presence of recovering alcoholics. The human natural instinct for an alcoholic is to drink. And life on life's terms, which is, you know, normal life, comes along. And the first natural instinct for a real alcoholic is to pick up a drink and not a phone. And that takes a lot of courage. And the most courageous people I know, I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I thank you for letting me be here tonight.